And we are live with our 302nd episode of Absolute AppSec. I'm Ken Johnson at CK Tricky on social media, joined by my co-host, Seth Law at Seth Law on social media. Seth, say hi.
Hey, all. Welcome back to another episode. Excited to be back. There's a few things that we wanted to talk through today. Mostly, though, just get back into the basics of application security, as you know, that is the name of the podcast. Anyway, so announcements from my end or from our end, there's a few training opportunities. In a couple weeks, we will be teaching a new version of harnessing LLMs for application security. I should say new version, updated version. This will, you know, be a little bit more progressive. We've taken the feedback from some of the previous courses that we taught and are implementing those across the board, not to mention the fact that AI changes so quickly from week to week and month to month. So there's that opportunity. Our course at Black Hat Europe is selling out. So if you are interested, that is a four-day course that combines harnessing LLMs and practical secure code review. It's a Black Hat special edition that we have put together and are really excited about, right? Like, this will be a lot more in depth and give us a lot more time to actually dig into the various aspects and techniques that we use on a daily basis. Besides that, we will be offering the course at KernelCon as well in April of next year. Who knows what it's going to look like at that point, because that is 6 months out and it all changes so quickly. The other thing that I can announce now is our course has been accepted for Black Hat Asia in Singapore. Same course that we're going to be running, the Black Hat Edition, will run at Black Hat Singapore. And I'm excited to get back to Singapore. I've spoken at Black Hat Asia before and have experienced that a number of times. So it should be interesting to see how things are in that section of the world again. This will also be combined, if you are unaware, Black DEF CON will be running right after Black Hat Asia, and there will be other opportunities there to see the security industry grow at large. It should be Asia 26. I don't think they've actually like dropped those in there yet, Ken, but we have been accepted, so we'll see when that actually all gets through. To stay up to date, though, with our training opportunities, training.absoluteappsec.com is the best place to go. And you will see these different items pop up, especially as the registration links are available. Or follow us on LinkedIn or the various other social media platforms. We do post from time to time. Sweet. Let's see. I think that's everything from an announcement perspective. Outside of OWASP, Global AppSec DC is going on this week. I've been getting texts about it. I will sadly not be there, and I have huge FOMO for that. So my question to you, Ken, to kick things off, what will be the big announcement or the big drama coming out of Global AppSec DC? I'm putting you on the spot here.
Well, I do know that the OWASP top 10 should be top of mind. Mm-hmm. Is that what you were thinking?
Sure. Whatever. Yeah. OWASP top 10, because that will be announced. We know that it will be. Brian Glass on the...
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's already announced. We've already scheduled that for actually next Monday. Brian Glass will be on the podcast to talk about the OWASP top 10 2025 edition. I'm really interested to dig into methodology and actually the basics of what they got to for the OWASP top 10, mainly because I use this on a daily basis. I mean, I know it's a part of your methodology over at DryRun as well, like identification of the top 10 items in code. We do that in dynamic testing code reviews as well. Like, it drives a lot of the finding layouts and recommendations that we make. So I'm interested to hear how things have gone, especially because we're a little bit over that 3-year cycle, right? Like, I'm interested to talk to Brian about how that's gone. their data collection. Typically, it's been 3 years that, you know, the OWASP Top 10 comes out about every 3 years. I guess this is the second time that we've slipped a little bit. 2017, it was, you know, 2013, then 2017. So I guess it is every 4 years, to be honest, at this point. They start everything about 3 years in, but I don't know. So OWASP Top 10 will come out. Any crazy predictions for new vulnerabilities in the OWASP Top 10?
Not new vulnerabilities in the top 10. No, I do. I mean, you know, the Gen AI top 10 is an interesting one as well. Generative AI top 10. I don't know if I expect to see like any. I feel like most of that kind of research falls out of Black Hat and the DEF CON time of year. But I could be wrong. I don't know. Actually, it didn't. So I guess I'm a really bad person to ask, because what I really expect to happen is there will be companies touting, there'll be people that are practitioners or that are just like whatever researchers that I don't know. They might come up with some variation or bypass. This is typically how I see the schedule kind of falling out, which is there's some researcher who has some bypasses for something. There's going to be folks who tout how AI can solve XYZ problems. I mean, I fully expect that. There's going to be some talks on threat modeling. I'd be surprised if there wasn't something around like SDLC and, even another talk on empathy around developers and things of that nature. I do think, however, in terms of like the hallway con aspect, you know, it was good 2 years ago in DC. It was decent a year ago in SF. I guess maybe I just go to too many conferences now, and it's just, I'm sort of like, what am I going to see that's new? Probably not a whole lot. Was there going to be anything that blows my mind that I haven't expected to already, or I may even already be involved in? Probably not. And I feel like that's not a nice answer. So do you have a nicer answer than that? Do you have something better?
I think OWASP Top 10 will have something related to AI in it. Like that'll be the interesting play as to where that actually goes. I will dig into it more next week, but I have like real concerns with this idea that the OWASP Top 10 has become a generalized list of risks for web applications.
Yeah.
And not a list of vulnerabilities, which, you know, it goes back to the fundamentals of what the OWASP Top 10 is and what people should be doing. It's an awareness document. But at this point, to cover the OWASP Top 10, right, like the vulnerabilities exist in there, it could be hundreds or thousands of vulnerabilities that actually roll up into it. And so it really depends on the audience or the speaker as to what they like to highlight. So, but we'll get into that next week.
I'm just excited to see people. But
And that's in general, right? Like we talked about SankCon and some of the other things, like the reason that we go to these conferences, security conferences nowadays is usually the hallway con.
I am going to pull up their schedule though, to see what the, cause like,
I was just doing the same thing. Yeah.
What are you? I figure I'd just be very transparent here. Basically I didn't think I was going to go to this conference. I should just be very like upfront about why So I didn't think I was going to go to this conference. Originally, we did not have a booth at this conference. My talk didn't get accepted. And, I gotta be truthful. I live enough of a distance away that this is not the easiest to get to for me. I'm going to have to stay overnight. It's like $1,200 for a ticket. And so the reality is like, if I didn't have like a business reason to be here, I'm not paying $1,200 and I'm not braving that traffic and I'm not staying in a hotel 30 miles from my house for this conference. So that I didn't even expect to be involved in this. Now, at the last minute, we got the booth opened up. We were able to get a booth. Our location's not great, but we did get a booth. So that's all right. Great. So I will be there for that. I'll be working that booth on Thursday and Friday. If anybody wants to stop by and say hello. And I actually, I don't know how you feel, Seth, about working booths, but since it's my company, I actually really do enjoy it. I probably wouldn't feel the same way if, well, maybe I would actually, I don't know. I think there's something nice about, explaining the product, explaining like how you can help, but also hearing like what are people's day-to-day concerns and things like that. But anyways, my point is like all of this for me is very last minute. So I haven't really gotten, and I run a startup, right? So like things are crazy all the time. So checking out the schedule and all this stuff, I should have done it, but I really didn't. So that's me being honest and transparent and saying it's all very last minute. I didn't really pay much attention to what's going on at this conference and terms of what who's speaking. So now I'm looking through them and let me break down what I see. There's a threat modeling talk. There's how to build AppSec programs and strategy and stuff around that. There's the let's see, there's some AI talks, like how to use AI in security. Have I missed anything so far that this is what I said was going to be on the schedule?
S-bombs.
In fact, yeah. This whole like second day is literally like, sorry, I'm looking at this. This is, you know, this is great. This Thursday, like the whole second half is, you know, there's like LLM backdoors in plain sight, LLMs and AppSec or AppSec, why they still need a chaperone, evolving your security champions program. I think might have mentioned that one was going to come up, or at least developer empathy and things of that nature. So, yeah, I mean, like looking at this, well, I will say this: we're going to talk about browsers, and there's like there's another talk about like latest browser security features and how they're eliminating classes of vulnerabilities. And I think that's important actually to hone in on, because we've got these AI companies building browsers, and we still have companies like Google trying to create and introduce bleeding edge standards to like thwart the things that are. So here's another talk about security champions. This one's a little different. Chinese RPC shenanigans in the NPM mirror ecosystem.
That's Paul McCarty. So oh, that is from Paul. Slack. Yeah. So of course that's interesting. Yeah. The one that you call out.
The yep. One talk I was like, this is unique. It's Paul. That's awesome. I shouldn't say the one. I should just say that's the one I honed in on. But I see Ken Huang, who I had we had speak at the AI thing and B-Sides RSA this last year.
Jason Haddix is there. He'll be doing his attacking AI talk. That's good. That's a good one.
Post quantum threats also looks pretty interesting. Real code finding fixing cryptographic risk at scale. That's cool. That's a neat one. That's Jonathan Schneier, co-founder of Modern. Sweet. But yeah, I mean, like I said, I mean, was I wrong? Like I didn't even look at the schedule and pretty much guessed what was going to be in it. And yeah. So.
Well, I mean, that's to be expected, right? Like, it's a global AppSec conference. I don't know. I was trying to think. I don't remember the last time I actually attended a global AppSec conference. It's been a while. It's probably the ones that we were like training at. And usually it's because the cost is pretty high, not super convenient to where I'm at. So,
And he is Robert Tonick, and he's like, I want to see some newer folks speak. I agree with that. You know, I like to see the hip young, the newer speakers. There's always a benefit to having like experienced speakers, because it's not always just, well, it's never just the content. It's also like can I listen to you for 45 minutes without wanting to walk out of the room? It's always a big, big one. But so there's that benefit of like a polished speaker or whatever, but it is nicer to see some newer folks, some new research. I'm hoping that B-Sides SF is gonna look a lot like that. I'm really, you know, it's funny. I never, Seth really was involved too much with B-Sides SF until the last few years. And I'm just like kicking myself because every year I go, I'm like, this is the spot. This is where I want to be.
Yeah.
This is exactly where I need to be. This is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, B-Sides SF has always been good. I don't know if it's just because it's like adjacent to RSA or it's in the valley there where all of the, there's a lot of security leaders and people that do tech startups that are more apt to attend B-Sides SF. It's that same crowd with, you know, Clint and Jivan and Asta from like Netflix and right, like all of those innovators, that seems to be the B-Sides that they attend and they help with. Whereas B-Sides Las Vegas doesn't get quite that same crowd or some of the other B-Sides events. I think it becomes more of a community event for the San Francisco security people than RSA, which is definitely like the sales conference that everybody and their dog goes to for the floor and sales meetings and all that kind of stuff. So it's, I'm with you. Like B-Sides SF is a great conference to attend.
Yeah. I will say this, funny enough, Seth, I never told you this when I was submitting a talk. But when I submitted the talk, they asked, who do you want to see keynote at B-Sides SF? I put you down.
What?
I meant it. I said it for real. I was like, I really would like to see Seth keynote this conference. And I actually meant it. I didn't just say that just because you're my friend. But anyways, I just
wanted you to know. Stress me out. Yeah.
No. But yeah, anyways, I'm excited about that. But yeah, I mean, like the thing is, really, I just know that I'm going to see friends. That's what I know. I know Thursday and Friday, I'll be working that booth and I'll be able to see friends and meet up. And I'm going to try, I think, and put together a little, because like last time we were down there, I did the dinner with like Brian Glass and folks. And so I'd like to, I'll probably try to put together on Thursday night another dinner with friends. But besides that, man, like honestly, kind of go in there, just, you know, talk about the company if anybody comes up and wants to, and otherwise see friends and, you know, Thursday, Friday, and then back to the weekend.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping there'll be some drama because I'm not there, right? Like that's the only reason, right? Something to think about and to...
There been drama in the past? I actually have not paid attention to there.
Not really, right? Like it's a global AppSec conference. It's usually pretty staid, and like there's a lot of, I mean, there's good info if you haven't been in the industry in the past or for a while. It's a good pulse of what's currently going on and kind of what practitioners are doing. But I do feel like it's always struggled with: is it a developer conference? Is it a security conference? Like, where does that line actually fit? Is it a consultant like ProdSec, AppSec, you know what I mean? Or is it meant to focus on the AppSec, the OWASP projects? OWASP crosses so many different boundaries that I feel like they've had a hard time defining exactly what global AppSec is and who the audience is that should be there. I don't know if you disagree with that, but that's, I know we talked about it in the past.
I don't want to say disagree, but I do think it's like software security touches a lot of different folks, you know, not just security people. So it's not a bad idea to have it. It's not a bad idea to like have it be geared towards multiple. Well, I don't know. What do I know? I don't run conferences. I never have. But I don't think it's horrible. I just think that as long as you stick to, like you said, that the core topic of software security is probably fine. But if you do want to incentivize like students, for instance, you've got to do certain things to get them in there because they're not paying $1,200. And I know that like conferences do that. They've got education you know, free tickets or deeply discounted tickets. But no, like I don't know. As long as it sticks to its core premise of software security, I think it's fine. I will say this. I want to just highlight what Robert put on the comments here, which is like, I think one of the things that people do, I don't know if it's younger folks exclusively. In fact, I'm sure that I would do this too. I don't think it's just an age thing or experience thing, but you see a similar talk and then you're like, okay, well, I shouldn't submit because like that's a duplicate talk or something along those lines. Or you may feel like I'm going to submit a talk and like surely somebody else is talking about it. I mean, that's fine. You might get rejected. What's the worst that happens? You get rejected. You know, it's like if you don't submit, you didn't even get rejected. You like rejected yourself. You didn't even put yourself out there. So don't do that. Don't like think that surely nobody will want to hear your unique take. But also because that, you know, people might be talking currently about the same topic, but their views are different. But also they may not just be like, people may just, even if they're a great speaker, they may just want new blood in there. Like Robert was saying mm-hmm. earlier.
Yep.
So don't talk yourself out of stuff, you know, just say yes.
Yeah. I mean, there are those conferences that do blind topic acceptance, right? Like talk acceptance based on abstract and description. But a lot of conferences, especially, you know, those that have been around for a while, are looking for new speakers, right? Like they're giving opportunities to those that haven't had the chance before, and they will reserve slots for that. So just because it is something that is similar, right, from a talk perspective, doesn't mean that you won't get that opportunity.
Yeah.
That might not be the case at a Black Hat, but I know they take it into account for a lot of the B-Sides events, for DEF CON, for other places. They ask whether or not you've been a speaker before, and that's exactly why, because they want to encourage people to get involved and actually start their career out and jump into speaking and sharing what they've learned, because it's different, right? The way that I talk about something is different than the way that Ken talks about it. It's different than the way that any of our guests on the podcast talk about it. Even though we've rehashed some of those ideas in the past, it's always useful to hear somebody else's take, to have their opinion, but also their experience, because they come at it in a different way.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, better to, yeah. I mean, unique perspectives, you know, everybody's, yeah. There's so many reasons. I don't even know where to go from here. I'm like, there's so many reasons to submit that it just doesn't make sense to not submit unless you, you know, for some reason can't get to that conference or there's some other reasons that block you from actually physically getting there. But if barring that's not the case, and it's just mental blockers, don't mental block. I think that's kind of the thing is like, I've had this thought for a while actually, and I think I've shared it with other people and they've shared their same similar perspective on this, which is part of like your life and my life and Robert's life and a lot of people that do public things and you know, build businesses, build blogs, build podcasts, do whatever. They're pretty consistently overwhelmed with things. I'm not saying the feeling of overwhelmed. I just mean overwhelmed with things on their plates. I think there's that kind of, maybe the easiest way to say is just sort of like that fuck it mentality. Like I'll just, yeah, sure. I'll do it. Yeah. Screw it. This mm-hmm. makes sense. It doesn't not, you know, it's not a problem. It's not, meaning whatever the thing I'm saying yes to doesn't conflict, isn't for one reason or another, there isn't something that precludes me from being involved in it. Other than I feel like, wow, that's a really big goal. That's a really lofty whatever. Or maybe I'm just already, there's a lot on my plate and it's really ambitious to try and tackle that. And the answer is, you know, unless, like I said, there's some reason where you're like, it's not worth my energy or... And you have a good reason for that, right? If it falls within the realm of good idea, but it's just that it's hard and it's a scary, basically, then fuck it. Go do it. Just go do it. And you're going to have a better outcome.
Yeah.
And that's everybody I've seen that's what you might consider a high performer, achieved whatever. That's how they behave. They just go after it and just say, well, you know, let the chips fall where they may. It's better to be the person who's getting criticized because you're trying to go achieve something than be the person criticizing people trying to achieve something. Mm-hmm. That's the way I look at life. But
yeah, well, I mean, going out and trying, the number of times that our training, our talks have been rejected, it's just par for the
countless,
course, right? Like countless. It just, you know, yes, we have the podcast where we can come on here and we can talk about whatever we want, but going to these different conferences, submitting however many times to, you know, training, like call for trainings, call for papers, the ideas that we've had that haven't come to fruition, right? Like way more than the ones that have actually been accepted. And it, you know, personally, right, like it can be discouraging the first couple of times that it happens, and then you kind of get used to the idea, right?
Just get numb.
Yeah, it's almost like, okay, well, that wasn't the right venue for that idea. Maybe they just didn't have the speakers for it, whatever. But just means that, hey, right, try again the next time. As much as you get those rejection letters and they actually come back with, hey, this doesn't, you know, this is not meant to reflect on the quality of your submission. They mean that. And look for feedback. Ask other people what they think. You know, drop the idea to your coworkers, to us, whoever, right? Usually people are going to be supportive of anything that you're putting out there because we know how scary it can be and how much energy it takes just to formulate a proposal. Especially when you look at the hoops you have to jump through for something like a Black Hat proposal or a DEF CON proposal. Like, yeah.
That's exactly what I was going to say, Seth. You've submitted and I've submitted, I mean, no less than like six times. I have to imagine no less than six times for Black Hat Asia, for instance, mm-hmm. right? That's how many times it took. And we were on the verge of being like, I don't know if we're going to submit because this takes a lot of work. And they always say no. Still did it. Eventually. Finally, yes, right? It's like that. You just keep trying. It's exactly what you said. You just keep trying, and then eventually you'll have a breakthrough.
Yep. You'll figure out exactly what it is that you need to put into that training or into that talk or what research you need to do for that to come about. And I know if you talk to like Jason Haddocks or Clint or anybody else that's in the industry, they'd tell you the same thing. That hey, a good idea is a good idea. And you're never going to regret putting some thought into a unique approach to whatever it is that you're doing on a daily basis, because it will make you a better AppSec engineer. It'll make you a better consultant. It'll widen your own thinking on those various topics. So, you know, yeah.
Yeah, it's got to be the human burp intruder to CF. Robert said, sorry, let me just put it on the screen. Just got to be the human burp intruder to the CFP submission pages.
Yeah. So I've found that, you know, running its denial of service attack against the submission pages, you know, after you submit is very helpful. No.
Just don't do that. Don't do that.
If you game the system. No, just kidding.
Oh, okay. Hey, speaking of, I mean, thank you for letting me know about B-Sides in London. I was able to register. And so not only are we going to give training in London next month, but we will be there for B-Sides, hanging out, not even talking, just literally attending talks and hanging out and just, yeah, being an attendee. So really excited. If you're in London, if you're going to be at that conference, like definitely hit us up. If you see us and you want to say something, say something. Like we want to meet people. It's really nice when you travel internationally. And you know, we don't get that opportunity a lot. Hey, I was going to tell you, Seth, last week was fun when OpenAI announced they're trying to kill off my business. That was fun.
Oh, yeah, that's fun. Yeah, it seemed like you got a lot of feedback on LinkedIn for that, right? Yes, I've seen it. Well, yeah. should we talk about Atlas really quick?
Let's shit on Atlas. No, I'm joking. I'm not crapping on Atlas. Although I kind of did pump. Yeah, whatever. Let's get into it.
Okay. So credit to Clint for including this. He didn't have a lot of discussion about it outside of posting that someone had discovered the prompt behind Atlas, which Atlas is as OpenAI's browser, right? Like, you know, so it's Chromium, but it has AI capabilities. Someone posted this on X. Now, like, we could argue, you know, on whether or not it is the actual prompts. Yeah, I wanted to talk about it for a little bit because it is super interesting, right? The capabilities, the instructions that are being given to a browser that is running within the context of your system with your credentials and what it actually has access to, and the ability to go out and retrieve and look up. Here, I'll share my screen on this one, or share.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I could also share, but yeah, you tell me what you want to do.
Yep, I've got it here. So, all right.
I'm literally reading it. That's why I'm looking up at this other screen.
Mm-hmm. You are ChatGPT's agent mode. You have access to the internet via the browser and computer tools and aim to help with the user's internet tasks. So there's, you know, and there's all sorts of instructions. I'm not just going to read through everything. There's a few things that stood out to me, right? yeah. Number one, extremely important. If the query is ambiguous and you're not exactly sure what they're referring to, you must use browser history, right? So you can go back through their browser history and do retrace in addition to doing general web searches to actually help people with their, you know, their internet activities. And then super, super important, if the user asks you to do something that requires data from one of their logged in sites, you must try to find this data. And to do this, you have APIs available and you can leverage those. You can also try using the browser history tool. So basically, comb the cache, comb any sites that the user has access to that they've logged into in order to answer those questions, right? This feels like, man, what did XSS just become? Right? Oh, like, God. I just, like, my mind is reeling with the possibilities of, oh, geez, what happens when we're able to actually inject content onto a site that is browsed by Atlas and break into prompt instruction with this prompt underlying the system, right? Like, credentials are gone. You logged into your bank, right? Like, you can transfer money. You can, I just am like, holy crap. Yeah, exactly, Robert. Like, why does this read like a DFIR level one forensic playbook on malicious browser extension investigation? That's because it is exactly what it is. It's combing through your entire browser history, search, access, and using that access to do things for you. Now, I'm not saying that's not going to be helpful, right?
What, you know, but I have one.
Do you really want to do this? Go ahead.
Yeah, no, sorry. I'm sure it's going to be helpful. No, I'm sorry. I just was trying to figure out if, like, is super, super important more important than extremely important? Or is it vice versa? I'm not sure which one takes precedent. No, I'm kidding. It's silly. But title of document. Yeah. Well, the rest of this isn't, I guess, super important, but, well, maybe it is.
No, it's not. Some of it is, right? Like, browser.run. Mm-hmm. Like, it has the ability to do, like, so computer.do. I'm taking it that this is an MCP server that's running locally on Atlas that allows for computer tasks to run, right? So to actually comb through various portions of the computer to do certain things, browser.run is go out and retrieve this information. Like, there's a browser MCP that you can actually interact with.
Do you notice how it actually, like, tries to tell the system when it talks about tools? It basically, one thing I was noticing is the tools that it's like, earlier it talks about the DOM and using the DOM and how that's a cheaper, more or less expensive option. You should prioritize it. And then later I saw how it said, do not click. Instead, use keyboard shortcuts when possible. It's kind of funny. It's almost like intentionally, but maybe unintentionally saying like use features that don't actually show what you're doing in a way, if you know what I mean. Like, it's kind of just laying the ground floor or the framework for basically like, hey, prioritize using tools in such a way where maybe some of those actions it takes won't be visible to the user. Not that that's their intention, but like I said, it's the way they've prompted it. I think that's kind of how it works.
Yeah, seems to be right. Well, I like some of these too, like some of the instruction feels like, okay, these are the way that you like make it less expensive, but you also bypass certain controls that exist within like the browser or within other places, like the, you know, the protections that we've built into the DOM, for example. Oh, well, we'll just expose an MCP server that allow us to get around that restriction to go retrieve this other information, have access to the browser history, to do things that are unintended. Again, it feels like a honeypot for cross-site scripting that doesn't have any sort of detections around malicious activity.
Yeah, that's probably a good way to say it. Man.
Yeah. This is fascinating to me, and so I understand why it is there, but the explicit instructions on how to use Google Docs as well is interesting to me, right? Like, why is it that it has like all of these instructions? Are they thinking that that's going to be like overall something that's that important, or maybe it just is their use case that they've come across that was unintentional or harder to actually define? Yeah, action to actually do things with computer.do, basic selection. Yeah, so I'm just kind of combing through this, but
I don't know, man. My theory behind these, because zooming out of like the technical aspect, it's like, why are they building a browser? And not just them, but why are AI companies building browsers and all these other tools? And people tell, you know, like, the one I hear the most is like that people say, well, you know, they're trying to find revenue anywhere they can. They're throwing business models at the wall and seeing what sticks. And that might be true, but the business models they choose, in my view, give you unprecedented levels of access into users' behavior, their data, the code that they write that you wouldn't be able to get from necessarily a public. Think about it this way. Whenever I want to get code, I have to either get it from a public source, or I have to get it from a private source, but that private source has to agree to things that would allow me to train on their data. And I can tell you, as somebody who goes through countless security questionnaires literally every week, every day, I don't think there's, I'm actually searching into my memory here. I don't think there's a single client that has said it's okay for us to train on their data. So why I'm saying this is, however, if you build a browser or you build a this or you build a that, and then all of a sudden it's plugged into various systems and people have opted in and maybe didn't always know that they were opting into this, you know, collection of data or you know, being used to train these LLMs. I guess what I'm trying to say is, how do you beat open source LLMs, right? Like, I don't know if you know this, Seth, but open source LLMs are starting to reach parity with the commercial ones.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing at that point that becomes a barrier to entry is like you just having to host it and eating the cost of hosting it. And I can tell you again, as a vendor that is AI backed, like a steady state LLM that I host and not your frontier model is more interesting to me because I can keep a steady state margins and I don't have to have variable inference costs.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm looking at a business that did something amazing, did something incredible, but unfortunately is seeing a situation where open source options exist that could beat them out. And then, so then it becomes, well, how do I stay at, like, to me, I'm like, well, how do you become the best LLM? Well, right now it seems like it's, and I'm not again, I think even though this is my life, I wouldn't say that it's, I'm even the expert, right? I would say there are two things I see though. There's the, you can train with more data, better data, train in better ways, you know, like, that was sort of the with Quinn, that was one of the breakthroughs, is the way they actually trained that LLM. There's some other things they did with optimization, like math optimization, but that's one way. Now, if you build a business that has access to users' browsers, access to their code, access to their email, access to their Google Drive, access to their, heck, their brow, not their browsing, but their, like with Sora, for instance, like you have, they literally built their own social media, like reel, where now you have like trends, like cultural trends, right? Because people are building videos around cultural trends. There's all these different things where I'm like, well, this just looks like ways to siphon in. Yes, it might be a way to get revenue to land, but it also looks like a way to siphon in data and then, like, yeah, have a better way to train LLMs. The other option, as I mentioned too, is to actually do with like Wolfram Alpha and that Wolfram Alpha group, mm-hmm. how they're like creating an entirely different way for LLMs to operate, where it's not necessarily an LLM, it's supposed to be more close to like true AI, true intelligence. So, anyways, I'm saying all this because it's like, then there's ramifications that fall out of making worse, less secure, less private, more feature full, and more feature full for autonomous intelligent systems to interact with. It's like browsers haven't figured out completely, and I'd say Chrome does a really awesome job, but I would say like that's not a solved thing. Browser companies are constantly worrying about security and privacy. And then you throw AI on top of it, and then it comes from some company who has many different business models. And I don't know, man. It's common. It's Atlas. It feels dangerous. So I don't know. I'm ranting, but I mean, do you see a different reason? Like, is it truly? Do you think it's the revenue? They're just trying to find revenue any way they can. Do you think it's?
I think it's a combination of revenue, but I think it's it's also that additional ability to train, right? To get more relevant, better data that is more plugged into the zeitgeist and how people are actually utilizing the web. I haven't looked at the terms of service for Atlas or any of these, you know, browsers, but I would be shocked if they're not. If there isn't a clause in there that they can use your data to train upon, because that's always been one of our big complaints about LLMs in general, is that they're not up to date, or the data that they're trained on, the LLM is only as good as the data that it's trained on, right? Like the prediction models, like when you get down to the math, what it actually is predicting is only as good as, you know, where they got that source from, right? So like if you're looking at open source projects, you're looking at Stack Overflow, then the code that you've got probably has vulnerabilities in it because most of that hasn't been vetted. Most of the clean code is private and is not, you know, those LLMs are not trained on that. But we look at it from the aspect of overarching OpenAI wants access to the current zeitgeist so that they can have their model be more relevant and be whatever it is, like actually tied in to people's use cases and what they're doing. So I think there is the money aspect for sure, right? They want to keep people's eyeballs, what we talked about last week. They want people to actually utilize them instead of other things that from an advertising perspective. But on top of that, it also gives them access to that data that they didn't have before.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm trying to find like, the most I see here is it says, so with ChatGPT Atlas, it does say, by default, we don't use the content you browse to train our models. If you choose to opt into this content, you can enable include web browsing your data control. My question is, and I didn't download Atlas, My question though is, do they do that sneaky thing where as soon as you boot up, there's like already checked options, and then you just like hit next, and you've just you're opted in without. I don't know. Like I'm probably being, but yeah, I don't know. It's just I don't have trust. I don't have trust in. Yeah, I lack trust. We'll say. I don't think it's that weird, but anyways, yeah. I don't know, man. The agent is literally told to access your browser history pretty much all the time. So it's kind of hard to say that you know there isn't some weirdness going on here.
Yeah. I think there's like everybody's already trusting these big companies, whether it is OpenAI or Anthropic, with a lot of data because they're interacting with those models. At some level, there is a certain level of trust with them. My fear here, again, is the fact that you're introducing a tool into your private system that has access to your private data that can then be exploited. So malware on your system, you are just enabling MCP servers that give basically complete access to your browser history, to other things that it might have been more difficult to actually get access to in the past. Realistically, there is a huge research spike from a security perspective that goes along with this as to what the capabilities are, right? Like, are we going to see a resurgence of, the Beef framework, right? Utilizing these browsers to actually take over a system, because at this point, cross-site scripting just became that much more interesting. And, we don't necessarily need to utilize the browser history DOM anymore from within cross-site scripting. We can just talk to Atlas and have it retrieve that for us, right? There's a lot of avenues here. Yeah.
Actually, because you said you talked, it's funny, you mentioned you're like, with MCP and the issues there, it's funny because I don't see a single MCP security talk in the OWASP global schedule. And that's actually, it's possible I'm missing something, but I'm searching for MCP model context. I don't see anything, and that's really odd. And the only reason I'm saying this is why I think it's odd is that, when mobile security came online, like it pretty much immediately, there were people flocking to talk about how to secure, like how mobile is different from traditional web applications, and then like what controls are unique to it, and then how to secure it or how to break into it, that kind of thing. I would have expected the same for MCP servers because it's like a similar thing, right? It's not a web app, it's not really a mobile app, it's got its own thing. It's really hard to get right for a number of reasons. The least of all is, like, for instance, like I can tell you with Cognito, by default, it does not support OAuth DCR, which is like really important if you want to implement OAuth with MCP. So the standards aren't super well supported. And there's, of course, products coming out now to help there, as you would imagine. But there just are a lot of, and like another thing too is agents, right? Agent tools. So, crossing streams where an agent should only have access for this particular task it's running to these tools, but instead it invokes another tool with elevated permission and access. And there's not like good boundaries there. That whole world is very, very new. It's actually really surprising. I don't see a talk about MCP here anywhere. That's really strange.
Which is interesting because TLDRSec, right? Like Clint's latest had multiple. It had a section just on new projects that are going after MCP servers, both from a protection and defense aspect, because it is becoming so prevalent, and trying to secure things like OAuth through MCP and other things. I know you and I have had that discussion, as it's incredibly difficult to do, and it's nuanced in a way that APIs and other things haven't been in the past. And to Robert's point, I'm sure we will see more of that next year as it solidifies or it matures that section of the industry. So I don't know if it's just they accepted talks so early in the cycle that they've missed this, or it hit after. I guess that could be it.
Yeah, because some of the there's talks about like, and this is I'm not being critical. I'm just saying like, there's talks about like prompt injection and stuff, and I'm like, yeah, like a year or two ago that was more interesting. Now it's it's like what Robert has. Like, I want to hear someone rip apart A2A, agent to agent protocol, because like, I think agent to agent is one that doesn't get enough press and like will become more, I think, more of a thing. MCPs was interesting because everybody built an MCP. So it's like everybody was like, well, I have a web app, I have a mobile app. Oh, I have an MCP app now. Aren't I like AI-ish?
AI-ish.
Yep. Yeah. So, I mean, so yeah, MCP is interesting in and of that, I guess, that it, you know, it can leverage LLMs mixed with tools and then mixed it with real data to give you some meaningful insights. Actually, I mean, I will say one, let's talk about that for a second. One thing, like people come to me and they're like, oh, do you have a REST API? And I'm like, yeah, we can give you access to the REST API, but why do you want that? And when we get into it, I'm like, you know, like your MCP server, not only can you get the data you want, but you can build a graph in real time right away. I can literally build, I've showed people this. I'm like, I can build right away using the metadata we have, like a velocity chart to risks chart by developer to show you which of your developers, unfortunately, are introducing the most risk, you know, like in a second, and make a pretty chart. So it's like MCP is really, really cool for that reason. It's not just access to data, it's also what can it do with that data, but then also once you've got that synthesized sort of like outcome, you know, the final product, you can then put it into something also at the same exact time. That's really pretty and a good way to storytell and have visuals. So that's why MCP is cool. But why I think agent to agent is really cool is that where I think things will go is this concept of when you look at LLM's attention, right? They can write code, they can read code, they can do those things, but not at the same time that they're very good at it. So what I mean to say is like, when you give, think about it this way, if you use WinServe, Cursor, or anything else, if you give it an instruction to build something, more often than not, it won't even go and look and see if you already have a function developed, not only in the code base, but like in its own history from stuff it's written. I've witnessed this multiple times where it wrote the code that had a function it could have, you know, called instead of rewriting it and duplicating itself. And it didn't take that into account. It didn't even think about it. It was like, I'll just rewrite that function and do it in a different, worse way. And then now I'll be calling that function in a different file that's like basically the same code, right? So why I'm saying that is that it's hard enough for it when it's just writing code for it to get that part right. And yes, I think when it comes to like easy SQL injection and patterns like that, like that's going to be filtered out of its training data. But in terms of it taking into consideration like other parts of the application and how whatever it's building might impact it from a secure security perspective, I really don't think LLMs are going to be okay at that for a little while. I'm sure at some point, yes, but not for a while. And why I'm saying that is it's the same model as humans, right? Humans can write code, they can try to solve a problem, but it's really hard for them to do that and also think about all of the security ramifications or even the QA related considerations, right? And AI is, like I said, it's very similar. So why am I going on this ramble? Well, I'm saying like what the world I think we're going to get to is that agents will need other agents to correct them, to guide them, to keep them on track, and to help them write secure code while they're trying to reason about what they should be building. And not even just secure code, but how do I, for these tools to improve, take into account wider architectural considerations and things I've written before in my own memory and things of that nature. So yeah. I think where A2A is going to be really important is not just from a security perspective, from a security builder perspective, where do I think it's going to be important? I think it's going to be really important that these agents can communicate with each other for those reasons, to keep code secure, to keep these things, you know, on task. And so anyways, I hope A2A becomes more of a thing and more widely discussed. And I also hope people find some problems with it, Seth.
Yes. There will be problems with it. I can guarantee that. Right. It's fascinating, right? Like realistically, that's what it comes down to. The orchestration that goes into it, the fact that it's not as magical as people think it is. You know, our initial thought was, oh, it'll do all these things. You still see quite a few people that do that. Hey, I'm just going to ask Claude Code to go build me a whole application, right? And then I'm going to ask ChatGPT to do the same thing. Which one was better, right? Like I saw that on social media recently. And obviously the tuned models do better than the untuned models, right? Like that is a common pattern. But a lot of it has to do with how they're orchestrated, how they're architected, what the communication streams look like, and what you're using to actually interact with those, because of the attention deficit that you're talking about, because of the, you know, the inability of anyone or any AI to actually focus and stay focused on the current task at hand.
Yeah. It's really hard for them to keep their attention focused correctly and accomplish. It really is. I mean, it's, for some things it's very easy, and it's fine and it's not a big deal. For other things, it is. And you don't always know when that's going to be the case, by the way. As somebody who is wholeheartedly vibe coded a bit, I can tell you, you don't always know when it's, and you have to be, I'm really careful now. Like I don't feel, I think I had more trust, and now I'm to the point where I'm fully on the, like, I have very little trust from that standpoint. So, but we try to do things. I mean, I try to do things, and the team does too, like where we actually give specific tasks to Copilot just to see how it performs. So we can get a sense of, you know, where is the market at? How are these systems performing in a real environment where we actually have things that we need, like bugs resolved. I mean, I even did something silly where I created an issue around how to become enterprise ready. And I just said, hey, you know, here's the outcome. Here's a URL of my assessment of if we're enterprise ready and what's remaining to do. Fed that in as an issue, assigned Copilot, and it built me out a nice little markdown roadmap. So, you know, lots of positive things to say about these systems, but at the same time, you have to be very, 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 very careful. And I do think with that in mind, agent to agent will become more important for QA, for security, and for what you said, orchestration.
Yep. Well, I mean, along those lines, like one of the things, and I know we're about out of time today, like I know we're going to do it. I was going to drop in here a link. This one is called SlopGuard, right? Like it's a testing framework basically for package dependencies. Like we've complained about this for a bit, how AI will hallucinate packages and attempt to install things that it shouldn't, like from NPM or whatever it is, just based on the name, based on the math behind the scenes. And so this Aditya actually built a tool to prevent that from happening and to check whether or not it's AI slop or whether or not it's an actual dependency before you go and retrieve things, right? And that's exactly what you're kind of driving at there, is we've got to have those protections in place. We've got to be careful with what it is that's coming out of the AI before we actually jump in and do anything with it. Oh, yep, there you go.
Yeah, they put it on Reddit. Like it's kind of funny. They said, I was cleaning up my dependencies last month and realized ChatGPT had suggested Rails-auth-token to me. Sounds legit, right? Yeah, actually, it does sound legit, by the way. If I'd pushed that to GitHub, an attacker could have registered it with malware, and I'd install it on my next build. Research shows AI assistants hallucinate non-existent packages 5 to 21% of the time. So I built SlopGuard to catch this before installation. It does four things. It verifies packages actually exist in the registries. It uses three-stage trust scoring to minimize false positives, detects typo squats and namespace attacks, and it can scan 700 packets in 7 seconds. Man, I need to add an NLCP agent for this. This is good.
Yeah, it's good stuff, right? And this is the sort of research like that 2 years ago we wouldn't even thought about, right? Like the fact that AI is doing this sort of thing. We probably would have laughed about it and moved on. But these are the real-world problems that we're dealing with. I know we had other links to talk about, but I do know we're out of time. You've got to
bail.
We got other things to get to. I do appreciate the interactions today. Interesting stuff as always. We will be back next Monday. Mark your calendars to talk with Brian Glass about the OLS Top 10. Anything else that you want to highlight before we call it today?
No, I'm just glad you're better at keeping track of the time clock than I am. Thank you. I really appreciate it. Sorry, I think I rambled a lot today. Thanks for indulging me, Seth. Thank you.
No worries. Appreciate everybody. We will see you all online, and we'll see everyone next week. Thanks a lot.